No, two banks, well, three banks, so there you go. The ones with the money. Great. So why don't we just jump right in? This has been a little bit oriented towards products, though we'll talk about services as well. And I think there's a twist towards not a little bit of math, but also a fair amount of behavioral economics, if you're familiar with that concept. Because one of the things, this thing is really jumpy. Any of you use one of these sort of yoga rollers? If you're familiar with these, you've seen them around, these little plastic, they're kind of heavy-duty foam. I was looking around just to try to get an example of how pricing might work. And so here's one. It's very basic, $10, right? You can envision, say, another one. This one has, I don't know if you can see, a little texture. It's a little smaller, so it's travel. Probably less material because it doesn't really cost much to press, but it's $24, right? All sort of fits. How about this one? What do you think this would price at then? We're talking about bringing luxury fitness home. It's got handles, so I don't know how you use the handles if you're rolling on your back. $99, yeah? What do you think? Others? $39. He launched it for $189, and it didn't do very well. But his wife, who was in the luxury business, said, your problem is your price is too low. Too low. He actually, I just pulled this from the Wall Street Journal, $365, a dollar a day, and it took off. There was something about it. It's luxury, it's different, it's got those bumps. Those bumps must do something. And by the way, you know, $300 a day, you'd replace it in a year if it goes bad, but it shouldn't. Sometimes the issue is the price is out of line with the market you're trying to get to. There are things that happen like this all the time. Pricing sends a message. That's probably the most important thing to think about. If you take something and price it low, people have a perception, right? So, any of you experienced that? If you went to a Mercedes dealer and they had a $15,000 new Mercedes, you'd kind of scratch your head, right, and think about that. So you have to think about where you are, right? These brands send a very clear message, right? Anyone familiar with Ryanair? Uh-huh. Yeah. Ryanair was actually thinking about charging to use the restrooms on the plane, thinking two things happen. First of all, they only do short flights. Second of all, I still make it available for you, but if you know I'm going to charge you to use it, maybe you'll do the best behavior, which is actually go before we leave. Believe it or not, if everybody on the plane uses the facilities in the terminal, the flight is actually lighter. Weight is a big part of fuel usage, and it also means there's less expense when they get to the other end and have to pay to dispose of things. Sorry?
The maintenance.
Yeah, absolutely. No, the other, I mean, they don't charge. I mean, there was enough of an outrage for that. On the other hand, they don't offer a lot of services. It's very basic structure. You want to go from one city to another in Europe, it's very cheap, sometimes $50. All right. You want luxury, you want a meal, you want first class, you want some choices, you want them to check your baggage, well, then you've probably chosen the wrong place. These brands suggest different expectations, right? Apparently pretty amazing to fly on that. You have to not need to ask what the price is, right? And generally longer flights, but really high service level, probably really high quality meals, lay flat seats, all of that kind of thing. So one of the reasons that we think about pricing, though, is I don't know if you've taken traditional marketing classes, there was always this thing about the four P's. Anyone know the four P's? Yeah? Anyone know the fourth one?
People?
No, it's not that. It's actually place. So what's the product? Where is it sold? What's its price and what's its promotion? And of that, the pricing has the most power potential. Somebody did the math, and I'm not going to go back and try to figure this out exactly, but if you raise the price 1% in these companies, a huge percentage increase in the bottom line if it doesn't affect the volume. It's a lot easier to add to the top if there's, you know, no elasticity of demand. So again, you have to be careful with that. But optimizing the price is probably the best opportunity for profitability. Let's do a little bit of math, right? I know it's early. Caffeine maybe not kicking in just yet. Everybody knows the basic P&L, I hope. So, you know, there's the gross revenue, which is, you know, what you sell it for, and then the cost of sales, the product cost gets you a gross margin. Then you have your operating expenses, and that gets you, along with these non-cash expenses, down to profit. And the reason we're looking at that is, in a given situation, assuming things are stable, which usually a bad assumption, but for the purposes of here, you can either increase the volume, you can increase the price, or you can lower some of your costs, right? And if we wanted to take an example of whether or not we do better raising the price or increasing the volume produced, you know, here's a power tool example. Let's assume that it is the wholesale price of $100, and we're selling wholesale. Cost to manufacture is 60, right? So the gross margin is 40. Fixed costs are $30 million, so that's basically, no matter what the volume is, you know, you're still paying the rent, you're still keeping the lights on, and you sell 100 million tools a year. So your math looks like this, right? Your total costs are the 30 million fixed plus 60 times 100 million. So your net margin is 10 million. If we want to go 5% up, either raise the price 5% or increase what we sell by 5%, which would be more profitable? We already kind of know the answer, but if you look at it this way, right, if you increase the volume, it means we're selling more, you used to get the 105, but the variable costs go up, right, because we've actually sold more units that we've had to produce. And so you end up, this thing's jumping very fast. Increase of 20% from a 5% increase in volume, right, because there's some pretty good leverage here. But if we do it by price, again, you have to assume that the volume doesn't go down, but the variable costs stay as they were, and the margin is now a 50% increase. Now, there's a lot of calculations in between. If there is some price sensitivity, maybe you lose a couple of percent. If you lose 5%, you're probably at about the same place. If you lose 2% of your customers, you're actually probably better off. We did this, we thought about this for the New England Aquarium a number of years ago. We were doing a project where they were really struggling with profitability, and one of the challenges, I don't know how many of you have gone to the New England Aquarium recently? Yeah? One of the challenges they have is that until they added the new wing, nothing changed. So when you go to the aquarium, you've seen the aquarium. If you have young kids, you can go a lot. But if you don't, the average visit was like every 2 years. And then, of course, during the summer, it's an absolute madhouse, right, with all the tourists and all the rest of it. So what we figured out is actually a woman from Staples on our project team. Why don't we do seasonal peak pricing? Raise the price during the season, lower it again when the season ends. If you raise it by 10% and you lose 10% of the customers, the visitors, you're in the same place. Only it's a better experience, actually, for the visitors that are there because there are fewer people. But the assumption was that we probably wouldn't lose 10% because it's a tourist destination. And they didn't. It actually added $500,000 to their bottom line and helped them be much more stable. Now, it was important for us that they drop the price back down, that this is not now raising the price just in general, because I think for the people who live in the area who've seen it, if you're trying to get them to come more than once every 2 years, the last thing you probably want to do is raise the price. When we think about pricing, a lot of times people think about your costs and do cost plus, right? That's the natural instinct. I know what things cost, or I think I do, and so I just need a little bit of margin to cover that. And I'm a little concerned about, you know, might I be too expensive? Will people be willing to pay for it? You know, those kind of concerns. And so the challenge is you need to really think more about it, both because it sends the message and because it's so important for your profitability. Right? Any questions at this stage? Reactions? Here's a bit of behavioral economics. This is a little hard to do. This is an older article, and nobody can imagine an MP3 player that's not an iPod anymore. iPod, what's even that anymore? But if you can think about something that you were going to buy for $29, and then a friend of yours says, look, if we walk 5 or 10 minutes, you can get the same thing for $10 less. How many people walk? Is it worth it? Yeah, I mean, 29 to 19 feels pretty important. Sorry? And you get to walk, right. So, and it's only a short amount of time. So a lot of people would say yes, unless research says yes. How about this one? Shopping for HDTV, you're in Best Buy or something like that. And we're looking at something for, you know, the lower end, $695. Someone says, you know, if we take a walk, we could save $10 on this thing.
No.
Yeah, but it's $10. You just walked for $10. Yeah. Well, this is $10. You know, anyone bought a new car recently? You go through the whole process, and then they say, oh, come and talk with the manager because, you know, we can protect your paint for only $700. Well, you just committed $20,000, $25,000, $600 more to protect my 25 cores. It's the same money. If we were perfectly rational, if we're willing to walk for $10, we're willing to walk for $10, but we're not. So people aren't exactly rational on all these things. All right, I may want to change to my own clicker. This one's crazy. An old friend of mine has been doing software pricing for years. And the model in pricing a lot of times is to try to find the optimal price, right? This is a classic demand curve. Anyone take economics in school? You know, so that the lower the price, the higher the volume. And if you find the right price, then this area under the curve is your revenue, price times volume. But you may be leaving opportunities. There are some folks here who are interested but can't pay that. You've gone beyond their willingness to pay. You've got folks up here who would have paid a higher price, and you don't capture that. And so what he has been doing with software companies for years is helping them think about maybe variable pricing, right? What happens if I make it an entry-level price and I take some of the frills away, but I lower the price? And what happens if I can think about adding some other things for, you know, this is an older time. Nobody really buys packaged software much anymore, but they, you know, the off-premise hosting, which is now known as the cloud or software as a service, was a new idea then. That was kind of a premium. You can see that you're filling in more of the area under the curve, right? There's another really interesting model. Harvard Business School has a process where a lot of basic functions for students are done as little student businesses by, you know, students at the time. And one of the things that everybody needs in the first year, because it's a full-time program only, is a resume. Resume, cover letter, you know, I mean, cover stationery and envelopes. And there's a look that is Harvard Business School look, which if you're out in the market, that's probably what you want to have, except that you're competing with a lot of other folks in your class that are doing the same, right? We're all looking for an internship job during that first summer. This one is the, you know, it's got nice paper, it's got the Harvard watermark on it, and the same for both. The basic one skips the watermark, it's more basic color, but it still has the same kind of look. You know, more cheaper paper. And then this one up here has, a really kind of fancy-ish paper. So you got the same, year after year, same number of students, same demand, it's pretty much like 90% will buy this thing. And this is how it's been bundled. Where do you think most of the buyers go? What's the biggest seller? The middle is actually, because, it's pretty high quality. Most feel like, well, that's probably what most people are going to do. You know, I don't need to be in the super high end, but I really don't, unless I really am strapped, I don't want to go cheapest,
yeah.
Right? So how do you increase either the sales or the profitability of both if this business? The market is another, it's the same size, the same entering class, same demand, year after year. One of the guys who took it on, who later became a senior partner at Boston Consulting Group, decided to unbundle and said, maybe the watermark and the paper are different things. Maybe at this price you get the right paper, but you have to add this step and this step to get to the watermark. Right? Now it's a little harder. So, everybody's under pressure. You got all these folks who are all going to go out and try to compete for the same internship jobs. So we're all kind of aware of everybody around us. Where do you think it goes? A lot of people moved way up here, right? So a simple shift in pricing strategy dramatically changed both the revenues and the profitability of the same basic package to the same audience, right? So again, it takes away some of the satisficing is what they would say, that people were willing to say, this one's good enough. This is harder to figure out. When you think about who else prices like this now, most of you have a cell phone, right? Do you know how your pricing works? Because there's the data piece, and you could have unlimited this, or maybe not, or maybe roaming, and then the voice is a different price. And there's a reason that they've kept that complicated. If you could make it very, very simple for us to compare, Sprint, Verizon, and AT&T, that would push everything down to the bottom, right? So by keeping it complex, we've got better coverage, but we've got less of this. It actually has served, we are all probably buying more than we need. Yes?
Is that kind of like a la carte type offer, like I'm in services? So mm-hmm. Would that be kind of like separating all your services?
It can be. Yeah, and it depends on the situation. Sometimes it's better to be packaged. This one had a sort of a crowd mentality and everyone trying to compare themselves to others. And so that's one of the reasons that one worked. It made the comparison harder. I think there's a risk in services of making things a little too complex. So you've got that trade-off. We'll talk a little bit about services more towards the end. There are other factors that drive a price. What does a can of Coke cost? Well, let's say if you buy it in a supermarket or maybe in a machine in the mall, maybe it's a dollar. How about if you go to New York, right? Maybe at the train station it's a buck and a half, and if you actually wait until you buy it on the train, a little more. Anyone ever have anything out of those little mini bars in the hotels? What's going on here? This is the same can. Something else is driving the price.
Demand,
Demand, availability, Yeah, I mean, you're stuck on the train, you're thirsty, there it is. It's a convenience play. It just goes to say that pricing isn't just pricing. There are other, again, one more human behavioral thing. I learned this. I was VP of marketing and advertising for Bradley's for a brief period of time. You worked there? So I was in the last year before the first bankruptcy, and then it went downhill from there. So we were attempting to turn it around, and we didn't succeed. But one of the things you could think about is in the aisle on the hard goods stuff, this is the coffee maker collection, right? And which one do you think is the most popular?
Well, $59.
Actually, it was the $89. I mean, there are people who will pride themselves in buying the cheapest, and the $39 one's fine, gets coffee made. The rationale appeared to be, look, I don't need to be extravagant. I'm not going to buy the fanciest one. I'm not going to buy the most expensive one on the shelf. So this one's good enough. So I'm kind of treating myself, but I'm saving money compared to this. We later added this one. What happened? The 109 went up quite a bit. You know, this we didn't sell many of these, but it really kind of allowed the same rationale. That, you know, you've got a comparison. 109, it's $40 cheaper than this, so I'm saving money. I'm not being ridiculous here, right? I can rationalize it. Sometimes there are ways of thinking about that. I know consultants sometimes offer packages in three levels. You know, look, maybe we don't do that much market research. I only talk to a handful, and I'm going to write a section of it, but I'm only going to do two drafts, and, you know, here's the price. If you want, you know, four drafts and make sure we've got plenty of review cycles, and, you know, I'll interview more people in the market and probably do some other elements of it, you know, that's a different price, and then there's a higher price. Again, a lot of times that'll result in the middle being chosen. The other strategy around it, to the extent you can do it, and I, as a consultant, think that way, but have very rarely been able to figure out exactly how to do that with my work. But the concept is you're then giving them a choice. Instead of, yes, I take the deal, no, I don't, it's like, which of the packages do I want? And that, in theory, makes it a little more likely that they'll take one. Anyone seen what's happened here? I mean, all the franchisees went nuts when this happened, right? These are little, slightly smaller things for $1 or $2. Going to drive a lot of volume. They thought they were going to decimate their margins. Anyone follow this? It turned out to be a key factor in increasing average check. A lot of people may be drawn by this, but then decided, all right, I'm going to get my usual Big Mac and fries, and maybe I'll throw in another something for a buck. I don't think anyone expected that to happen, but I thought this was one of the many things about turnarounds for McDonald's, the other being that people realized people are willing to eat breakfast all day long.
Yeah.
I think diners in the Midwest knew that for, you know, decades, right? There are also, or even IHOP or something, but it took McDonald's some flash of genius to figure this out. This is just from May, actually. Here's one last math challenge. Well, actually, I can't promise it's the last one. But when people promote things, you know, if you can think about a price discount of 33%, or I'm going to give you extra value in the package, 33% more. Which one's better? Those of you looking at the slides can see where you're going, but
B,
you think is better, the bonus pack? Anyone agree? Everybody caffeinated yet? Yes?
You mean better for the buyer?
If you're the buyer.
I think it depends on the buyer. I think A is better.
Well, it's the same ice cream, let's say. Or here's a model. Let's say it's a gallon of ice cream at $9, which is maybe probably a very high price for ice cream, but it's a nice round number because we're dealing with thirds. If you do 33% off, then you're getting the gallon for $6, right? Which is $2 per third. If I give you 33% more, it's 9 for 4 thirds. It's actually still, it's more expensive. So they're not equivalent, but we generally aren't good at percentages, so we do think of them as equivalent. It would have to be 50% more to be equivalent in this case. I mean, this is a warning as a buyer, but as a seller, this also works. You could think about that. It's just a thought. So let's get to how do you actually think about these things. I'll give you a bunch of reasons to think that pricing is an interesting category with all sorts of fun things that can happen. You do need to think about your costs, and you do need to think about your customer's market and willingness to pay. But you really need to be thinking first about your positioning and your points of differentiation, right? So these are just the basic steps. You know, make sure that you understand strategically. Where do you want to be? Are you Lord and Taylor, or are you Walmart, or are you somewhere in the middle? Actually, in the middle is a little complicated. But where are you on this? Is it high service or low service, a self-service? Who are you trying to get? Because you can't get everybody, right? And then you do need to factor the costs and the competition, but you need to do it in this order, right? Because they're really, you can simplify things by just thinking about three different levels of positioning, right? Luxury is really, this is price doesn't matter, whatever price you can set. But usually very limited volume, very tight control, never discounted. You don't expect a clearance sale in the Rolls-Royce dealership, right? You're not looking for the spring rebates. And one of the challenges, if you're one of those companies, by the way, is then if you try to actually increase your volume, you lose this. Companies like Michael Kors, very fancy handbags, you know, $1,000, $1,500, $3,000 handbags. When everyone can have one because they started discounting, nobody wants it anymore. Because the reason that people in this category want one is because only so many people can have one. It says something, maybe not a great thing, but it says something about people to be rolling up in a Rolls Royce. You get stuff like this, $5 million watch. I mean, this is hideous to me, but that's what happens when you put 1,300 diamonds in one little thing. But you know, they probably aren't going to sell a bunch of these. You won't find them on a counter. This is a private sale in a back room. I don't know. But that stuff exists. Premium is maybe more where we're familiar. And there's a broad range of premium. You know, I think about Apple. I mean, you know, if my laptop, I could buy a cheaper laptop if I was willing to work with Windows. It's elegant except for all of the stuff that you have to tack onto it. They don't do a lot of discounting. There are occasional promotions, but not many. There's some expectation of quality and superiority of either design or functionality or simplicity of use or something. The fact that it connects with my phone and, you know, that I can find my calendar anywhere and those kind of things. So limited special offerings. I mean, Macy's will run sales. You know, department stores. It's sort of in the middle tier. Porsche is not as unattainable as a Rolls, but it's not your everyday car. And then there's really the cost-driven ones. If you're going to be a cost-driven one, you really need to be starting from the beginning, understanding that we're really driving all our basic costs out, and what are the things we invest in and what are the things we don't. Right? Walmart began its life as an everyday low-price retailer. Right, not a lot of sales, but everyday low prices. That saved them a whole lot of operating costs and a whole lot of advertising costs. When I was at Bradley's, we, as a much smaller organization, we were only in $1 or $2 billion. We had advertising as 5% of our sales. And Walmart was running at 1%. Now, and the other thing that was hidden is every Saturday night, store people had to go and reshuffle displays because something that goes on sale at 50% off in a circular would increase from 10 units a week to 100 units a week. You can't leave it in its little shelf on the shelf space. You need to build a bigger display for it. So every week, we had store people taking down displays, building displays, moving product around. Walmart doesn't do that. So huge cost savings throughout. They're also, their volume's much more predictable. So their logistics were better. Their in-stock was better. I mean, again, it ripples through the entire system. The other thing that happens is if you don't start there and you think, well, this is a good place to go, right? We recently watched JCPenney try to come up with a square deal. JCPenney had a long, long reputation of being kind of high-priced, but good sales. And if there's a coupon, it's a good deal. Well, you take away the sales and the coupon, you're still left with the, but they always were a high price. Now, they say they've lowered their price, but it's going to take about 2 years for customers to understand that change or accept it or believe it. So anybody follow JCPenney when they made that change? Volume dropped like 25% almost instantly. Stock price dropped about 30 or 40%. CEO was out in less than 11 months. And the CEO was actually not an idiot. The CEO was the guy who, before his stint at JCPenney, created the Apple Store. Arguably one of the best retailers in the world. The highest profit per square foot by orders of magnitude. Right? If you go into malls these days, all the stores are empty and the Apple Store is bustling. That's the guy that blew it at JCPenney. Partly, they didn't have this idea. They didn't have the trust level yet. So you kind of have to start there. Once, Southwest Airlines followed the Ryanair model. And they used to, if you wanted to fly from the Boston area, you had to go to Manchester or Providence, right? Because Logan's more expensive. Well, now they fly to Logan. They didn't used to give you seat assignments. Well, now they give you seat assignments. So they've kind of compromised a little. And the risk is that they get closer and closer to being just like everybody else, only now a little lower quality in the service. I mean, when they're $100 and everyone else is $300, yeah, that's what you expect. If they start sneaking up to 200, you know, the gap's not the same. So playing in this field really requires kind of a commitment to stay there and to think about all of your activities as being consistent. So it's a strategic decision. And then understanding customers. What do they care about? Because a lot of times we worry about, you know, one of the things classically, if you're selling in business to business, if I was a buyer, I know I did this myself. If I don't want to talk to a salesperson, I can just say, well, you know, your price is too high. It's a very easy way for me to just blow you off. It's often the first excuse. It's often not the reason, right? So what are the other things that matter? A colleague of mine had a client. This was in vacuum chambers. I don't even remember what they are now, but they're an industrial piece. So this is a business-to-business industrial thing. Their volume was declining. They thought they needed to lower their price to try to get their business back up. She did this research and found, you know, this is 60%, two-thirds, saying product quality and customization are the things that matter to me. If I lower my price, would they worry that that stuff's going away? This is what matters. So why don't we just invest a little bit more in highlighting that? In fact, they raised the price, and the volume went up. right? Because they didn't lose customers because they were still the best at customization and product quality. So you need to do this kind of research before you think about lowering the price if things are going too slow. There are other things that could matter, commitments and the like. Travel, we're all used to this. If you book your flight at the last minute, it's going to be more expensive. If you book it at the very last minute, it might be cheaper because they don't want to fly an empty seat. But if you book it on the day or 2 days out, it's more expensive than if you book 2 weeks in advance or a month in advance, right? So customers, people will do that. The Saturday night stayover, I'm not sure it exactly still works that way, but why would a Saturday night stayover make your flight cheaper? Sorry? Well, so what does it say about you? Who doesn't stay over on the weekends? Sorry? Yeah, business people on an expense account. They always want to be home on Friday. If I'm staying over on Saturday, chances are I'm a tourist. I might be more price sensitive. If I'm flying Tuesday, coming back Thursday, chances are it's a business trip. I'm probably expensing it to a company. There's a little more room, right? And they make it pretty clear. Then there are other things like, variations. The costs a lot less to watch the Red Sox from the bleachers than it does from the first baseline or behind the home plate. So there, if there are ways that you can add some variability, again, that works a lot like my friend's software business of trying to fill out all the different areas under the demand curve. Here's an interesting one. Not too many people can do this. Anybody a Costco member? Yeah, how about an Amazon Prime member? So yeah, that's even huger, right? So we're paying $99, soon to be $129 for free shipping, among other things, right? Wait, we're paying for free shipping for things we might buy in the future. There was an interesting article I read about it when this was first happening. It was only $79 only. The analysts in Amazon went to Jeff Bezos and said, I don't think you should do this. So because, look, the people that are buying a lot are spending $200, $250, $300 in shipping, and now you're going to give it to them for $79. He saw something else. He saw the behavioral economics of, now that we've done that, where do we go first? We go to Amazon because the shipping's free. It's not free because we paid for it, but it's already, now it's free, right? So the other thing is, if you can get 1 million people to give you $79, that's actually not so bad either, right? The fascinating thing with, so Costco, this was done in 2015. I think it's still the same economics. $2.5 billion just in membership. Those of us paying $50 or $100 or $150 for the opportunity to shop in their stores and pay them for the things we buy. Their bottom line was right about the same. So that money just goes straight to the bottom. And they're basically selling everything at slightly, just enough to cover their operating costs. Right? So if you can parse out different ways of getting paid, huge renewal rates there. They had this conversation, and everyone was worried when Amazon went from 79 to 99. 99 is kind of this magic number. Once you break over 100, how many people do you think dropped at 129? I don't know the number, but I don't think it was very large. And since that's a 30% increase, unless he lost 30% of his customers, Prime is now giving you movies. It's your prepaid shipping. You have the one click.
Christmas trees.
Yeah, exactly. It's that kind of pricing relationship embeds a loyalty it's hard to do. It's hard to get that to happen. Asking about willingness to pay. Very hard. I've tried it a few times. I did one for a doctor who had a clinical support tool. Now, part of this runs into a bunch of challenges. One is the doctors that I'm surveying don't know what this is, right? So we're trying to describe it as best we can. I was able to say what the issue is. And I asked, this is what I read that pricing experts say. If you ask people, like, what's a fair price? What's too high? What's way too high? You know, you get some useful information. It's still hard to work with. Because, again, people don't really know until they actually see it. So there's a lot in the startup world now. People are talking about minimally viable product. Have you heard that term? The idea of create something even if it doesn't, it's not quite great. In fact, the first iPad was one of those, even though it's at a higher scale. Anyone get the first iPad, the first generation iPad? Yeah? I have one too. It only could do one thing at a time. So even like if you're getting email, you can't open an attachment because that would mean two programs have to be open at the same time. It couldn't do that. Had no camera, right? Mainly he was testing a relatively low-powered chip and a battery that should last about 8 hours. And the question is, would people use it to watch little videos and you know, read web pages and move that reading experience to the couch? Right? It's still pretty expensive, but he didn't have to invest in all that much. When it sold very well, then they say, okay, now we have evidence. People showed us by sending us money that there's interest in this thing. So now I can build a better chip so that I can do multifunction. I can put a camera in. I can do all those things. The challenge in the first generation is that chip, which is a big, big investment, in order to... It probably would have had the battery run out in 3 or 4 hours. And his belief was, if this thing doesn't stay open most of the day, then I don't have the value proposition I thought I needed. Right? So again, that's a way of getting money without making all the big investments. But what happened when I tried this was I got a range. One of the things that you find is when the mean, you know the difference between a mean and a median? Mean being the average, you take them all and you average it together, and the median being like, you know, 50% of the incidents are above and 50% are below. That tells you that there's a bit of a spread. It's not a bell curve kind of thing. And this is in per cost per dollar per month if you were selling a software into a medical practice. The answer is kind of played out this way. And, you know, so how do you interpret this? There's a bunch of people that wanted it free or that. My client decided, well, I'm not interested in that market. There's a few folks that are willing to, you know, would put a really high value on it. But this is kind of a barbell shape. So the average, which is here, doesn't really make us feel very encouraged. Now, he hasn't gone to market yet, so I don't know how this ended up working out. My interpretation is he had two options. One is, if you can find who these folks are, if there's a certain kind of, if we could have found a practice, we only surveyed 600 doctors, but if we, and you know, we did it electronically, we didn't go out and talk to them all. If we can find that there are certain practice areas where this would matter, maybe we could launch the high end and what's called skimming. It's sort of like when Apple launches a new product and the people that wait outside the door and around the block, they'll pay any price. And then a little bit later, you bring the price down and you bring in the rest of the market. Or you could decide that it's going to be somewhere in this range. And I think that's what he's shooting for. Maybe what you could target is $95 or $99. Seemed like a possibility. Yes?
What's the correlation between the price and that percentage? Is
so this is how many of the respondents.
Right. So can you say if you get the 1% by the price, 11% times 200 versus 20% times 100, is that a valid comparison?
Well, two things that are dangerous about doing that. One is because these are numbers, we think there's some precision here. but I asked doctors their opinion and they gave me an opinion. So there's a number here, but I don't add a lot of validity to it. It's not actual data, it's a point of view. And the other is, it's going to be one price. And the question is, if we price it at 100, do we bring all these folks along? Or do we lose all these folks and only bring these folks along? You know, what's the chance that we could get these people at $90? Well, it's per doctor per month. So, you know, if you have 10 doctors, that's a little more significant, and it's every month. But you're right. The other thing is, if this is a really quality tool and it's available for 10 bucks a month, you know, maybe I don't trust it, right? Yeah, exactly. It really feels like, again, it's the perception thing. This is a tool, a clinical diagnostic guidance tool doctors are going to use. Yeah. Could be. That's more likely to be older doctors than younger doctors. Younger doctors are usually pretty excited about new technology. And in this case, it's a decision support tool that the doctor uses to kind of run your patient through something, you know, ask these questions, enter this, and we'll run an algorithm. I'll tell you that you probably ought to run a few more tests on this patient. Or you don't need to. You can tell the patient they're fine. Yeah. Well, that's a huge thing that I haven't put in this, but I actually learned that the hard way with a startup that I did in the internet bubble days, where we created a platform to move large digital files between companies for marketing and advertising. It was based on what I learned at Bradley's, where, let me step back, and I'll get to the answer. But I'll try to do it short. Bradley's, in final years, we were carpet bombing the whole Northeast and Mid-Atlantic with 6 million circulars a week, right? Those 18 to 36 page inserts in the newspaper, 6 million every week. There are only a handful of printers that can print that volume. They're not here. They're in North Carolina or they're in Virginia. So we had to get our files, when we started making them digitally, to those places. Well, in the 90s, I hate to say, I feel really old, last century, at the turn of the century, we didn't have broadband yet. It was just starting to emerge. So we actually copied all those files onto a physical hard drive and FedExed it every day, you know, because we, you know, we'd take all week to build the circular. And so we were FedExing these hard drives, and they were FedExing them back, and it means we had to be done at 5:15, and they don't get to the printer or the, you know, the pre-press until 10:30. There's all this time wasted. What if we could do this electronically? And so that's what we kind of created. And one of the things that we thought about in the mind of the buyer is that each of those FedEx packages was like 10 bucks. Ad agencies were doing this. Corporations were doing it because they're the person that prints their big brochures or their annual reports is not in their same market. Or even if they're in the same market, they're not in the same building, so you still have to physically get it somewhere. We thought, why don't we price it like a FedEx package? It costs 10 bucks each time you move a file. What we found, because we did get a couple of early adopters, we had Delta Airlines, we did have Digitas, we had EMC Corporation, we actually had DreamWorks Music. But the people that had it knew, okay, if I use it, it's 10 bucks, but even though it's fairly straightforward, I haven't used it yet, maybe I'll use it next time, you know, because it's variable. You don't incur the cost until you use it. We thought that would be attractive. And it was attractive in getting people signed up. It wasn't attractive in getting them to use it. In the later days of the company, before the whole economy collapsed and all ad agencies started to panic because all of their customers went away, we introduced like $250 a month. $250 a month, I should use it because I'm paying for it. if I don't incur the cost until I use it, I don't have to use it today. I'll use it tomorrow. And tomorrow is next week. So I think, yes, there's an issue there. That if you set a price, the other thing you can do with a price like this, so $100 a month, if you want to get the cash flow to look a little different, we say it would cost you $1,200 for a year. I'll do the year. If you pay it up front, I'll do the year for $1,000. Right? You've seen those kind of things all the time. It first of all gets the commitment. It also gives you the cash flow. Financing your company, it's always wonderful if you can get your customers to give you money sooner and you give them product later. That's, money in soon, money out slow, usually the best formula if you can do it. He hasn't launched this thing, so I don't really know how this has worked yet. But this is one of the challenges that happens when you try to research a thing that doesn't exist. And people in theory doing that, worse if your survey audience are people you know. Because your friends are going to tell you nice things. And your mother's going to tell you nice things. But that doesn't help you when you go to market. I'm working with a different doctor on a different medical software product of a similar character to this. And he built it out extensively. And he's down in Florida. He's got a lot of doctors that are his friends in this practice, and they all love the idea. Of course, they'd use it as well in their practice. And they all signed up for it because it's software as a service and it's free to sign up. And 30 people signed up for it, and one of them used it once in 2 months.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Because, we like the idea. It's just, I don't need it for this patient right now. And I don't actually need it for this patient right now. And now that it's been a couple of weeks, I kind of forget how you told me to use it. So I'm not going to embarrass myself and fumble in front of a patient. So when I get time, I'll go in and take a closer look at it. But I've got a golf game this weekend, so I'm probably not going to do it now. It continues. So we actually learned that he was targeting the wrong audience. And he learned it after investing a lot in the product development. If I had met him a couple of years earlier, we would have stopped him with fewer instances and one specific specialty, and then we could learn that and then change it at the time, and which was what we're doing now. But he's got a lot of money already burned. So unfortunate. Now let's talk about your costs. There are other things about, you understand the contribution margin, people think about the gross margin, the idea that if I sell a few more, I get at least a little more money to cover my overhead. But a lot of times they don't really think about the impact on what that does for various things. So, for example, restaurants or museums, we already talked about the aquarium. You've seen restaurants that might increase prices on a Saturday night or a Friday night. If you've got a 3 or 4 hour waiting list in your restaurant, maybe you should have higher pricing. Uber gets everybody pissed off by doing that on a rainy day when you really need to find a car where there never used to be taxis, and we had to wait an hour for a taxi, especially like in New York. The people that are willing to pay a higher price can get one, because a higher price will motivate a driver to come out. It kind of upsets people because it's a change. We're not used to a change. And maybe it goes beyond our willingness to pay. But even if you do this peak pricing, even if you lose a little volume, you usually can make that up if it's really truly a peak. On the other hand, people have tried that on the other side. A discount for Tuesdays. If you go out to dinner on a Tuesday night, if I made it cheaper on a Tuesday. Challenge with that a lot of times is there's probably a reason people don't go out on Tuesday night. They've got 3 more days of the week afterwards, and it doesn't feel like a weekend. But the people who are already coming on Tuesday, you've given them a discount. So in fact, you probably lose money on this deal without driving new volume. Right? So you have to think about the behavior. There's another interesting thing. It turns out that sometimes companies find that their largest customers are actually losing the money. They're the most demanding. They want the most service. especially if you've given them volume discounts. And you figure you make it up with the smaller customers, but the smaller customers are smaller, right? The other thing that tends to happen is people set pricing tiers. If you're in a situation where you can price by tier, you're better off doing something like this. Let's say, you know, if you buy 300 of them, I'll give you 30% off to try to motivate that. The first 100 should probably still stay that way, right? If it's $100 with cost of goods sold of 60, if you do it this way, the profit comes down close to about $9,000, right? If you give them 30% off, that means you're selling it at 70. Whoops. And you can see the profit impact. A lot of times people don't think about it. This volume discount at a certain stage can really hammer you. So there are different ways of handling it. I don't know if that applies for some of the things that you do. That's kind of more of a business to business. Again, when you think about competition and willingness to pay, part of the thing is thinking about, all right, do you have points of differentiation? You know, this is sort of the thinking that's kept like small retailers having to compete in the Walmart era and things like that. Walmart has lower costs, but you could have a better experience, or you could have a better quality, or you could have a nicer ambiance, or any number of things. You know, can you change the game a little bit? Because you don't really want to get into a price war with somebody who's a low-cost producer whose whole structure is designed around that. So sometimes it's bundling or unbundling. We talked about unbundling with the resume opportunity, or even shifting to, you know, I mean, you can buy a car or you can lease a car, for example. The different ways of reducing the monthly costs. I've seen people that when they're buying the car, they think about, what's my monthly payment? One of the ways they can reduce the monthly payment is to make it, you know, it used to be 3-year car loans. Now it's 5-year, 6-year, 7-year car loan. Your monthly payment is lower, but yeah, your interest will be huge. But people might take that deal. This gets into business models. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of Hilti. It really isn't a consumer brand. You have. So you're in the construction world? Sorry?
We're manufacturing.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I mean, part of the idea is they make some, apparently, I can't vouch for it, but I believe they make some of the highest quality tools. And if you're thinking about being on a construction site, a lot of times if you're a small contractor, you buy the tools you know you need, or maybe you buy an inexpensive one at Home Depot, and it, you know, because it gets you through this job, but maybe won't last as long. What if you could have all the tools you needed, but you didn't actually have to buy them? You just rent them. You know, it's kind of on a lease thing. So I have all the tools I need. Now, the Hilti has to have, they end up owning a lot of tools. They have a lot of inventory. But they've got a lot of people that are paying them a little bit every month to have this. And from the point of view of a contractor, they don't all of a sudden have to buy this whole set of tools. You know, so again, a different business model. They're taking a pretty nice profit as long as you have the capital reserves to hold on to all that inventory. You can do that in funny ways. I mean, this was a concept around, you know, you go out and you buy a book and then you put it on your bookshelf because you're going to read that, right? What if you could just have those books, and only electronically? But what if you could have them all and only pay for it if you actually started reading? I mean, you already know that Amazon is reading over your shoulder. This company would read over your shoulder as well. You know that they read with you, right, if you're reading on a Kindle? Any of you been to their bookstores? One of the things that drove this home for me, I went to the first one they opened here is in Dedham. And I went in, and they had a special display of what they called page turners. These are quick reads. How do we know that? Because our Kindle readers finished it in 3 days. Oh, how do they know that? Because they're reading with you, right? They're with you. They know all sorts of things about what we do. This idea was, I'll take the friction away. Have the book. Pay for it if you use it. You know, you kind of got that with Spotify as compared to iTunes. I don't buy the music. I just, you know, stream it. It didn't actually succeed as a consumer business. It is still in business. It's actually working with libraries. So it ended up, they inadvertently solved a different problem they hadn't thought about. You know, the library, you know, our public libraries have to think about, people want to borrow e-books. Well, if I lend you my e-book electronically, I still have it. So do I buy one copy and I lend it out to 50 people? That would really not be good for the publisher. But if I can track that I'm lending it out to only a certain number of folks, well, now I can lend it out to everybody, and they all will kind of be using it as they read it, or I can shut you off if I've already got 10 people reading it. I don't know. I mean, I think libraries have opened up to this idea. So this was a failure as a consumer deal. You know, you can bundle things. Movie costs $10. The popcorn or the soda costs $3.50. What if I give you a bundle deal? Again, probably like Prime, we might buy it in advance, and then maybe I'll get the soda, maybe I won't. But at least, you know, I'm giving up some of the margin, but I'm probably selling more soda, right? Or what if I get you to prepay for 10 movies? You know, again, it's a lot like Prime. Any sort of bundled opportunity. I have a woman that helps me with, you know, random and infrequent tech support issues. Because I run my own office, so I can't call the tech guy, because I'm the tech guy. I'm not very good at that. Her model she came up with is, she sells a card. It's not a physical card, but it's technically a debit card. And her price is $1,000 at, I don't know, I think it's $100 an hour is what she runs. So I pay her $1,000, and I'll get 10 hours of help. And it'll expire in 12 months. And every week she sends me an automated email, says you've got $700 left on your card, or you've got $650 left on your card. It expires in May. It is kind of interesting. It's, you know, because if she waits and I need a couple of hours of help, you know, she has to wait for that, and then she does the help, and then I send her a check. Now, she's got the money now, and I've got the peace of mind that I can call her at any time. She tends to be pretty available, but her cash flow is stabilized, you know, and I've gone quite a few months without even remembering that. Well, she sends the reminder, so that encourages me to remember, oh, yeah, I probably should update a few things, and she's still there. Sorry? Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's, again, so, and then, you know, she found some resistance when she raised her price, so now she's, well, I'll give you 6 months for $500. You can buy it in these kind of chunks, right? So, you know, I've got a few more things on service points, but I guess wanted to just highlight. So the key takeaways, pricing is really one of the more powerful levers. Strategy and positioning and pricing all have to align. Your pricing sends a very clear signal, but your strategy and your positioning enable certain kinds of pricing. And all of these kinds of different approaches offer potential, but you have to make sure you understand what the costs are. Anyone heard of something called MoviePass? Well, this was the idea of trying to compete with like Netflix, where Netflix, the model was, used to be $10 a month, and then you could receive as many DVDs as you wanted, as long as you get new ones when you return, back when there were DVDs. I feel so old, because that was their second iteration, not their first. One of the challenges is, so, all right, for $90, I think it was, or $80, you could go to as many movies as you wanted. Sorry?
It was unlimited, yeah.
Yeah, unlimited. But then they lowered the price to $9.95. And I think their assumption was, like a lot of gyms work on this, right? You know, it's 10 bucks a month for some of these gyms. It's because a lot of people don't actually go very often. So those of you who go every day, you're being subsidized by all those other people who pay for it and don't go. There are a lot more members than the gyms usually can handle, and they're relying on a certain percentage just actually feeling good about it. It's only 10 bucks a month. I'm going to keep it going because one of these days I am going to go. We know that. I'm going to start next week. Those are models. When they dropped it to $9.95, I think they found there are some people who will go to a movie every day. And the economics turned kind of way upside down, and I think there's a question of whether they survive anymore. But it's interesting trying to take something that works online and bring it into the physical world. And other people are trying to do some of that. Services. If you're an accountant or a lawyer, or a lot of times freelancers, the model has been by hour. And it's a terrible model because of a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, is it my time that's worthwhile, or is it my knowledge? If I already know something I need to know, so I can do something very quickly, does that mean that I shouldn't get paid very much? It also can give me the incentive for bad behavior. You know, in order to really understand your market, 15 interviews aren't going to be enough. We really ought to do about 50 of them. That's going to take me some while, right? But if I'm being paid by the hour, or maybe I want to actually get the design perfectly. I mean, it's almost ready, but it's probably not quite good enough, so I'm going to spend another couple hours and really clean it up. Or I'm just going to work a little more slowly. I mean, I'm not saying that ethical people will do this, but the incentives are misaligned. If somebody could do something for you very quickly and get the outcome you need, that's the value, not the time they spent doing it. You need to know that I sweated till 2 in the morning working on this thing, or do you just need to know that I produced something great, right? It also creates this perceived easy comparison. I mean, you got a lawyer at $300 an hour and a lawyer at $350 an hour. Which one do you want? I don't know. Is that one better? I don't know. Is it? How do you know? But it gives you a unit that seems like it's comparable. One law firm may really be expert in your market and one not. But the one that's not is cheaper. They'll probably actually spend more time. It may not even give you as good advice because they're not expert in your market. Right? So there are ways to do that. But the problem is identifying the value and making that clear and then trying some bundles. The lawyer that helped me do my will, finally, offered packages. Because that's kind of standardized work for a lawyer. And so here's the one. Look, rather than just going on LegalZoom or something like that, I will walk you through this. I'll guide what you do. I'll review what you do. You'll do it, but I'll give you the guidance and I'll make sure that it's right. And I'll charge you this for it. And I don't know exactly how much time that's going to take. If I'm actually very responsive to her instructions, I already kind of know what I'm doing, she's probably not going to spend a lot of time with me. Other people she may have to spend a lot of time with. If you want me to do it, you know, here's the price. But you know what it is, going in. Not like it's $350 an hour, I don't know how many hours it's going to take. It's probably going to take, I don't know, X. But you don't really know what the price is. Here I know what the price is. And here I can even add some things like, look, I will review the file every year, make sure the rules haven't changed, ask you some questions about maybe your kids don't need to be supervised anymore. Maybe we need to tweak a few things. So it's a little higher. Yeah? Gets her out of the hourly race. Makes it fairly clear. Here's a package. I know what I'm going to spend. Is this worth it to me, yes or no? And by the way, I've got some tears. So yeah, if I'm kind of choking at this price, well, we can do it cheaper if you're willing to do a little work. Yes?
So do you recommend for that they also offer an hourly rate as well, or just the package?
She, I think, would say, if you get past a certain complexity, or if you have, you know, an unusually complicated thing, we may need to add some hours on top of that, and so you can do that. I also, we were talking, Michael and I were talking about when somebody did my website, they said, look, you're a pretty good writer, so I'm only going to edit. You're going to write, I'll edit, we'll do two edit cycles. If we need a third edit cycle, then I'll do an hourly rate on that. If I need to actually start writing, then we need to either come up with a charge or an hourly rate for that. So, I mean, you can define the parameters. The issue is if it's a 25-page contract, you're probably going to turn them off. So she has just a few things that say, yeah, this is it, and for 90% of my clients, this works fine. And for the odd situation where things get really complicated, you have a convoluted situation, let's talk. And maybe we have to set it at a different rate. Right? Again, it's simple. It's clean. The other thing that's interesting, I don't know, I haven't really worked with large law firms since my startup days, but they actually have a timer on their phone, right? Every 6 minutes, that's a tenth of an hour. So if you're chatting with your lawyer about the weather and how your son's doing or your daughter, whatever, if you tick to 6 minutes, you paid one-tenth of $350, $400 an hour. So then they have this thing, they've got these hard numbers, and they have to decide, well, I should discount a little because we did sort of chat. But then they have to probably deal with their partners because they now have this whole system. You're either tracking in detail or you're not tracking in detail. Mm-hmm. If you're paying me by the hour, you're going to want me to track my hours. You're going to want me to show you, here are all the things I did. I don't like tracking all that stuff. It's a waste of time. It's also, I'm not very good at sitting down and thinking, well, what did I just do? Or, you know, wait, I was thinking with you for 20 minutes. Let me write that down. Now I've got to do something else. I mean, there's a lot of benefits to not doing the hourly. I do a lot of work in the nonprofit arena, and they constantly ask, so what's your hourly rate? So I don't have one. Now, I know what my costs are. I know that if I think it's going to take 20 hours or 100 hours, I know what I think I want to have, and I have an implicit number, but then I have to look at what do I think their budget is, what do they think the value will be, and if I can make the two meet somewhere, that's what I go with. So I tend to say I'm doing a strategic plan, and it's going to be X, and you're going to pay me this much up front in the progress payment and this much on completion. Yeah.
So when you just said about, you know, it's going to take X number of hours.
I think it's going to take.
Mm-hmm. So, for instance, when you're a lawyer, do you think she came up with those numbers saying, okay, a full service is X number of hours, and I built this, therefore, generally, I would charge you $6,000?
Yes. Yeah, I'm sure that that's what she's thinking about.
I really think you just don't track it that way anymore.
Right. It's implied, and it's not the unit of measure. So you don't compare it to.